We continue now with the thought of Thomas Hobbes and the guy who's the big materialist, spoils the party for everybody else. Nobody agrees with that, but it doesn't flag him in the least, doesn't bother him. Hobbes sets as his agenda his ontology, which is that everything is physical. I already explained that he's not clear on whether he's a strong materialist or a weak materialist, but he's definitely not a dualist. A dualist is somebody that says it's not true that everything is only physical. Some things are purely rational, and it's the combination of the purely rational with the purely physical that brings about the world that we experience. And humans have a bit of that rationality. Rationality is divine, the physical matter is divine, that is, they both have independent existence. We are beings that are both. We have physical bodies and we have a rational mind. So we're able to know the rational truths and so on. Not for Hobbes. No. No. What we do is calculate. When we reason, all we're doing is adding and subtracting words the way we add and subtract numbers in arithmetic. That's his epistemology. Try not to laugh. It's pretty crude and excessively simple, but that's what he wrote. All of our real knowledge, when we increase our knowledge, it's all derived from what Hobbes calls phantasms. We would call it a perception. Or maybe a sensation. So we see patches of color. We feel resistance when we hit something. We experience sounds, tastes, touches, smells. That stuff is what registers in human brains. And that's where we get all our information. It's what we experience. Perceptions, sensations. In fact, we can't really think of anything that we haven't experienced that way. Because when we try to create fantastic things, new things, all we're doing is combining pieces of other stuff that we already perceived. So we can think of a horse with wings, but we've already seen beings with wings called birds, and we've already seen horses. We just think of putting pieces of one with pieces of the other. But we haven't come up with anything new that we didn't experience. All knowledge comes from perception. And I told you before that emphasis of knowledge of coming from experience is called empiricism. Now, people can be empiricist partially about knowledge, empiricist totally. The vast majority of people who have been empiricists and like that, didn't mind being called that, were people who were not total empiricists. Hume tried to be that. And tried to get away with it. We'll see why he didn't succeed in that when we get to him. But Hobbes is the other one who's saying, yep, it all comes from experience. Now, why are there people that are resisting that, you might ask? Well, what's the alternative? The alternative is to do what most of the guys are doing that we're talking about, is saying that our experience is divided. Well, maybe that's a bad way to put it. Our experience has two components. There's an empirical part to our experience. But we also experience, not in the same way, but experience the laws of logic and the laws of mathematics. And those aren't objects that we perceive with our senses. But once we know about these logical truths, we can't get them out of our minds. And we can then see that every time we reason correctly, it's in conformity to them. Let's take as an example the fundamental axiom of logic. It's called the law of non-contradiction. Here's an easy way to remember it. Nothing can be both true and false in the same sense at the same time. So no belief can be both true and false in the same sense. If you shift senses on me, then all bets are off. At the same time, things can be one thing and then change and be another, but at the same time, in the same sense? No. So if I owe you $20 and I haven't paid it back, then either it's true that I owe you $20 or it's not. And it can't be both. I can't say to you, oh, well, I did pay you. And you say, no, you didn't. Oh, well, that's right. I didn't, and I did. Then you're going to think I'm just clowning around, or I'm ready to be locked up in a padded room. Contradictions can't both be true of the same thing in the same sense at the same time. There are other logical rules as well, and they're all equally obvious. There are mathematical formulae and rules. 1 and 1 is 2. That doesn't give anybody any problems, does it? It's an obvious truth. We say it's self-evident. That just means it looks irresistibly true and nobody can think of a good reason why it isn't. Okay. But that doesn't come from seeing one thing and another thing make two things. If I see, I hold this up and I hold this up and I put them there, I say this one and this one makes two. But if I add a spark to a pile of gunpowder, it doesn't make two things. It makes an explosion. It's very unlike two things. It has to be the right sort of putting together. And it's something then that I see examples of in my sensory experience. But I don't see that 1 and 1 is always and everywhere 2 at all times. I don't see that with my senses. It's the everywhere at all times, right? That you don't see. I can see that one thing and another thing make two things right now on the top of my desk, but I can't see that that was true 1 million years ago, and I can't see that it's true 1,000 years from now, not with my eyes. So they're called rational truths. We have these intuitions of rationality that are as certain as anything we could have. If you listen to Pascal, Descartes, you listen to any of the great thinkers who worked in logic and mathematics, and they're going to tell you that these things are self-evident. The law of non-contradiction was what Aristotle thought was the most certain of all truths, that nothing can be both true and false in the same sense at the same time. So, we have Mr. Hobbes here saying that rationality isn't so important. You just calculate, and our ordinary reasoning is adding and subtracting words the way we add and subtract numbers in arithmetic, and that's it. Most of our information we get from our senses. And we have seen that he wants to say that the individual is the primary social reality. Any groups are formed by individuals choosing to come together and create the group. So what then is the state? What then is the political institution of society? Well, the state is created by agreement among individuals. Here again, I went over this briefly, but I'll recap a bit. what we find in the state of nature, as we naturally are in the world, are solitary individuals trying to survive in a certain landscape. There isn't even a plan for reproduction. Having sex and reproducing, those are things that just happen accidentally all over the place. There's no marriages, no families, no schools, no institutions of worship, nothing. There's just individuals on a landscape. Trying to survive means you have to make your own clothes, your own weapons, get your own food, defend yourself, so on and so on. That is no way to live. Hobbes says that's the natural state of humans. They came into existence, and that state of nature is, in his own words, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. You don't last very long being your sole defender. It's because of all those inconveniences, Locke is later going to call them inconveniences, like being eaten by a bear is an inconvenience. The inconveniences of that kind of life are what drive people to get together and try to form a unified group, make an actual social institution. They're going to create it by agreement. And the first thing that they do, Hobbes says, is they all agree to give up their right to everything and create a sovereign. Now, he chooses that word carefully. He doesn't say king because he knows that has associations in Britain with the monarchy and the royal house there and so on. A sovereign of some sort. This guy is going to be the supreme authority. Everyone in the state of nature has a right to whatever they can get. There is no theory about rights and law and so on. There are no things that are naturally right or wrong. There's just whatever you can get and keep is yours. It's like talking about the right of self-defense. Self-defense comes naturally to everybody. And Hobbes says all rights are like that. They're natural. They have to do with survival. But this group gets together and they agree to give up their rights to the sovereign. They make a deal among themselves, and they all give up their rights, and they give the sovereign the sole right to make and enforce laws. In fact, the sovereign isn't even part of the deal. The contracts among the people, they agree among themselves to create the sovereign. The sovereign doesn't have to agree to any conditions. The sovereign is just now the big mahaf, the final authority, the maker of all laws, and the enforcer. But what that means is that there's going to be some sort of constabulary. There's going to be some sort of armed force that enforces the laws the sovereign makes. And that same armed force is also going to protect all the citizens who are party to this contract. So, the sovereign makes laws. Maybe it's no one's to be out in the streets after 10 o'clock at night. It doesn't matter what it is. Your taxes are $100 a month. Doesn't matter what it is. Sovereign makes the laws. The sovereign has the authority over an armed force to enforce the laws and to protect the people who are the members of this contract, who have entered into it. And Hobbes says that's the way all human society came about. It was only after they did that that they formed into families, larger family groups, the wider family, that they formed into businesses, maybe labor unions, schools to educate the young, and so on and so on and so on. These different institutions arise within the state, within the political institution that exists to make and enforce laws. Now, that theory is not going to go over well with the rationalists. With the other people that we're going to study, they're all going to want to make the laws of logic and mathematics one of the divine realities. And they're going to say that we think best and rightly only when we think in accordance with those laws. And they're going to want those natural laws of logic and math that determine truth and falsity to be a big part of formulating what a society should be and so on. They're going to say that that right rule is a rule of reason. That's what Aristotle had already said. 2,300 years before this. But here, this is what we get put forward by Mr. Hobbes. And I'm going to come back to that and to his materialism later on. But the two points now to remember. He's an individualist. The basic reality in human society is not the group, it's the individual. Let me do something by way of putting that on my blackboard. There are individuals and there are groups. And the question is, which is the basic reality? Which creates the other? Is that individuals come together, make a contract of some kind among themselves in order to become a group and appoint a sovereign, appoint a ruler? Is that how it works? And then you get the group. Or is it that you have a group that evolves to such a size that it becomes self-sustaining? It can have, it provides its own food, its own clothes, and so on, and then appoints a ruler as an individual. But meanwhile, it's the group that's the primary reality. The primary reality produces the individuals. Remember Aristotle, the solitary individual dies? Well, that's what he wants to say there. He holds that it's the group, the state, that is the basic unit and the basic institution. Now, let me say something right away about this and not keep you in suspense till we come back to it. From a Christian point of view, is it individuals that create groups or groups that create individuals? And the answer is, neither one is right. God has created both. Individuals and groups. One of the Psalms says, he sets individuals in families. God has created both. They interact with one another, but neither is the source of the other. And why is that important? Let me tell you, it's important. And it's important this for this reason. The people that say that it's individuals that create the groups then don't want the law to afford a full range of rights to any group. It's the rights of the individual that always trump the rights of the group. They come first, foremost, and if there are any rights for groups, they're derivative of the rights of individuals. If you're a collectivist, you hold that it's the group that's the primary in reality. And the group has the rights, and individuals have them only when the group grants them. So the whole notion of rights and equality before the law is wrecked by either of these. One always favors the group over the individual, the other the individual over the group. And neither one can come to a balance because they're committed either to saying that it's collectivist, it's the group that's primary, or individualist. It's the rights of the individual that are primary. Neither one. Neither one, from a Christian point of view, as I see that. All right. I think that we've done enough with Mr. Hobbes. It was, after all, just a, what would I call, a quick convenience to an add-on to add a thinker so out of step with everything that happened after that him for 200 years. In fact, it's really more like 400. Because serious materialism arose in the 19th century with Marx, and it arose in the latter part of the 20th century with academic philosophy in general. But not until. So we are poised and ready now to launch into the modern period, the 1600 to 1800, which begins with Descartes and ends with Kant. Are you ready? Because I am. We're just going to tear right into it. Right, let me get my blackboard back. Okay. And we'll start here, of course, with René Descartes. Descartes was born into a family that was fairly well off. He had a good education. He valued original thinking, creative thinking, and while he was still very young, he invented analytic geometry, a way of applying algebra to geometry, and that made him famous all over Europe. Anywhere you went, Europeans would know that name. And he did some other things. There are, some of you know, Cartesian coordinates that are named for him, and so on. But he liked most of all to do philosophy. And he had a habit of staying in bed till noon every day. He'd wake up fairly early, but he'd stay in bed, and he'd do his work in bed, writing, thinking about math, thinking about philosophy, and he himself did not feel troubled in important ways by a lot of the problems that he came up upon. But the century into which he was born was troubled. That century was preceded by the 16th century, the 1500s. And in the 1500s, three forces, cultural forces, emerged, two of them brand new. What had prevailed through the Middle Ages, I'll call the medieval culture, was an arrangement whereby the church ruled a person's soul and the state ruled a person's body. The two of them were the big authorities in life. There was the state ruled by a king, there was the church ruled by a pope. Between the two of them, their rules covered the whole of life. In fact, sometimes they collided with each other. It was hard to tell which one had the right authority in this matter right here and now. But the general scheme was church and state. That accounts for the whole of life, just as a human being is a soul and a body. Okay. And this medieval time was a time when people greatly revered what had come down to them from the ancient world. They thought a great deal of what little they knew about the ancients, like Plato or Aristotle, about Greek culture, about the Roman Empire, about all of the accomplishments the empires had put together between the Greek and the Roman. They saw the Roman roads, they saw the Roman ruins, they knew about all that stuff. But they didn't have one central authority that spread over the entire empire the way they had before Rome fell. They didn't have one central body of laws and a court system. They didn't have one central monetary system. Things fragmented and fell apart. And it became a time of great, of relative uncertainty. You didn't have the empire and its army to fall back on to enforce a court ruling. You didn't have the courts to make the ruling. If you didn't continue schools of education, you didn't have judges and lawyers capable of taking a case to court. And in fact, the only institution that through this darker time, subsequent to the fall of Rome, the only institution that did preserve schools of learning was the church. And it preserved them for the monks and the priests and the ordained clergy. It didn't exist in order to prepare lawyers and judges and businessmen and accountants and so on. So it became a time when there was a kind of grassroots rumble. There's an uncertainty to life that wasn't there before under Rome. The Empire of Rome. Between the church and the state, the authority had been taken care of. It ruled all of life. Now, church and state continued into this time of uncertainty, but the uncertainties really blossomed and became enormous in the 1500s. Because all through the 1400s, a movement had been taking place at first quietly and then loudly and then almost overwhelmingly called the Renaissance. Not only did people in the 1300s, 1400s admire ancient culture, they had gone back and dug up a lot of it. They found old writings that described life under that empire. They discovered the rationalism that the ancient world had been rooted in, both the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, in the idea that the laws of reasoning, the laws of mathematics and logic, pervade the universe, pervade the cosmos, and give it its order, and that those same rules and laws were capable of being understood by each human reason, and reason could employ them to understand the world and people and to make life better. That was called the rebirth, the Renaissance, rebirth of ancient world culture. And what is being reborn is largely rationalism and that commitment to reason that sees human beings as superior to every other thing on earth because humans alone operate by reason. I'm going to read to you a short section of one of the ancient world plays. This is a play by Sophocles. It was written in 441 BC. And here is what he has the chorus chant in the middle of this play. Many are the forms of life, wondrous and strange to see, but nothing appears more wondrous and more strange than man. He, with the wintry gales over the white foaming sea, with wild waves surging around, wends his way across the sea. Earth, of all gods, the most ancient, the first, unworn and undecayed, man, with his plows, travels over and over, furrowing it with horse and mule every year. The thoughtless tribe of birds, the beasts that roam the fields, that brood in sea depths, he takes them all in nets, knotted and snatted, snaring mesh. Man, wonderful in skill, and by his subtle arts, he holds away the beasts. The beasts that roam the fields or tread the mountain's height and bring the binding, he brings the binding yoke upon them, upon the neck of the horse with shaggy mane, or on the bull with a mountain crest, untamable in strength. And speech and thought as swift as wind, and tempered mood for life in higher states, or the higher life of states, excuse me. These he has learnt, and how to flee the clear cold of frost or the darts of storm and shower, man the all-providing. Unprovided, he meets no chance the coming days may bring. Only from death still he fails to find escape. Though by skill of art he may teach him how to flee from disease incurable. Man is the supreme being on earth. By his reason, he dominates all the other living forms, even the strongest beasts, and he achieves a temper, a personality that is accustomed then to life with other people, the higher life that's achieved only by having a state, having an organized society with laws, lawgivers, law enforcers. Only from death he fails to escape, yet, because he yet may learn how to conquer incurable disease. What an exalted view of human beings and their reason. This is the view that comes back, that is retrieved deliberately from the ancient world into the European society of the 16th century. So you have within this century the old regime, the combination of king and church. You do your work in the fields and you go to church on Sunday, and that's what life consists of. The state rules your body, the church rules your soul. Now you get a revival of man as supreme. Man able to form not only states and the higher kinds of life that come about with the state, but a multi-sided dominance of his environment, of the planet on which he lives, with his windswift thought and its more subtle moods. He dominates everything. Only death he hasn't conquered. And he may get that yet. He may get to that one yet. Now, with that, however, comes a lot of the old philosophical controversies about the truth. In the traditional medieval regime, I'm calling it, church, state, tradition, the traditions are held sacrosanct. Everything is done by custom and tradition. The Renaissance thinker wants to rethink it all. Let's see how else we could do that. What else we might believe about this? You have this custom? Oh, how do we know that really happened? The Renaissance is a shock to the traditional view. Now there's a third force, however, that arises also in the 16th century. And that's the force of the Reformation. Within the church itself, the church being the bastion of the preserver of custom and tradition, of a sacred authority, there arises a Reformation that claims that the church has gotten the gospel wrong for the last few centuries. In fact, quite a few centuries, and has majored in minors and added invented stuff that didn't belong there at all. And there is the attack on the greatest of the authorities. So in a time that reveres custom and authority, you have a challenge to the church, you have a challenge to the state, you have a challenge to custom, you have a challenge to tradition, and everything seems to have had the rug pulled out from under it. What's certain then? What's sure? What can we count on? Well, the Renaissance says man with his windswift thought will answer that. We will figure out the world. We will create the sciences. We will create the philosophy. We will devise the systems of ethics and of law. It's people who know this stuff that should rule in the state. And the Reformation says we have to go back to the original gospel. The scriptures that we have are an authority. They are reliable. But we may not just take them by rote. We have to do more than that. And we have to keep the church from including false doctrines and invented doctrines. And that hasn't been done. And we intend to do it. And for their trouble then, they were excommunicated. They're thrown out of the traditional church and said, you're not going to come tell us that what Christianity is. We'll tell you. So you have three competing forces, each one of which is at odds with the other two. The Renaissance says reason will discover the truth and what counts as right rules and set the customs and all the rest. The Reformation says, no, you find that in Christianity. That is true. The scriptures are reliable, but the church oftentimes messes it up. I think there of the preface to the Unified Book of Common Prayer in the English Church. This is 1565. And it opens with this sentence. There is nothing by the wit of man so well devised or sure asserted as hath not in the passage of time become corrupted. There's nothing by the wit of man so well devised or so sure that will not in the passage of time get corrupted. That's a very reformational attitude. The gospel was committed to the church. The church has messed it up. It needs to be cleaned up and reformed. And now we'll present the gospel. And then there's the traditional view. No, the old medieval view is the right way. We'll keep the old customs, we'll keep the old traditions. There's king and church, and they're the two alliances in life. You don't need more than that. That was a time of great upheaval with these three views going loggerheads at each other. And one of them clearly emerges as the winner. I mean, comes to dominate the progress, the course of Western European civilization. Coming out of that 16th century into the 17th, which is where we start with Descartes, you will see Descartes start as a Renaissance man. He himself is a Christian. He's a Catholic. He doesn't renounce his faith. He wants to remain a good Christian. But he thinks the challenges to the old views are essentially right. We've got to start all over, he says. Let's sweep away all the tradition, all the custom, everything we think we know on the authority of someone else or some other body of work. We'll sweep it all away and start all over. Start at rock bottom and ask, what is it that we can't be wrong about? Is there anything that is absolutely sure and certain? And having swept away everything else, we're going to start with that and see what else we can add to it. See what else it requires. See what else it makes at least highly probable. We're going to build on that foundation. That's Descartes' challenge to the world in which he lives. It looks at the century before, at all the upheaval and all the uncertainty brought by the challenge of the Renaissance and the Reformation and the traditional king-church combination that had ruled medieval life for centuries. And all three of these at odds with one another. While not rejecting Christianity as his own faith, Descartes does want to start in the way that the Renaissance program dictates should start. And his way, then, is to say, we have no absolute foundation for anything until we can find what it is that cannot possibly be false. So his way of beginning with philosophy is not as the ancient Greeks or the medievals did, to start with a theory of reality and go to a theory of knowledge. Descartes flips it. He starts with a theory of knowledge and says, what is it we can't possibly be wrong about? Let's start with that and then see what other things we can add. And then we'll build on sure and certain foundations and deduce whatever else is reasonable to know. So what we find in Descartes is that there are two problems that he's going to take as important. One is, can we trust our senses? Can we know that there really is a world that's just like what we perceive it to be? And the other is, can we know that God is real and God has created us and the world? Are those sure and certain? Let's sweep away everything, not even consider that the senses are veridical, not consider that God's real. We're going to have to show that on the basis of what cannot possibly be false. Is there anything like that? What do we know that couldn't possibly be wrong? So Descartes proposes a method. He calls it methodological doubt. Let's start by doubting everything that can be doubted. Not that we seriously doubt it. We don't really doubt whether there's a world around us. We don't really doubt that we have a body or so on. No, but methodologically, as a method, we're going to put it in the doubtful column unless it's based on something that couldn't possibly be false. Let's keep putting everything that can be doubted in that column that we're getting rid of for temporarily to see what's left, what survives, what is it that can't be wrong, and can we prove all these other things on the basis of what can't be wrong? And he says he thinks he can. And that's exactly what we're going to cover when we reconvene and we talk about how Descartes tried to do this. What is it that can't be false? On the basis of that, can he prove that the senses are reliable? Can he prove that God exists and created the world? And Descartes' answer is, yes, I can do all those things. Watch me. And that's where we're going to start next time. Be sure to do the reading.